Welcome to the latest Watercolors Aquarium Gallery podcast brought to you from the Aquarium Rush Studios in downtown Grand Rapids, Michigan. My name is Ben.
I'm Amy.
And I'm Charles.
What do you guys feel like talking about today?
Charles brought in some really good gin.
Spring has sprung.
Yeah, we're drinking spring drinks today.
You know what goes well with gin? Books.
You know, you are actually right. That's very astute. Maybe that's why we're feeling scholarly today.
Right. Sitting down with a nice gin and a good saltwater aquarium book.
Oh, man. That's a match made in heaven right there.
I know.
That sounds pretty nice. Oh, wait. That's kind of what we're doing.
That's it. For our regular listeners, you are well aware that we started a podcast on aquarium books. And because we are so long-winded and there's so many cool books out there, we decided we need to make that a two-part series. So the first section was on freshwater aquarium books, and this section is on saltwater aquarium books.
And yes, there might be a little overlap between that, this and that, only because it took us longer than it should have to realize we really should have split those up.
That's sure. Very true.
Yeah, we probably will need to start a little bit of like a previously on. Why do we care so much about aquarium books or books in general? Don't we have the internet? We should probably go back over that a little bit.
We did make some really good points last time about the verification of knowledge. And documentation and all of that fun stuff. That's definitely something that happens in a book that doesn't happen with, you know, a 15-year-old sitting behind a computer who's had an aquarium for 6 months.
There's a certain anonymity on the internet. There we go. That allows for some unfiltering on the internet that you have to convince someone to publish your book, or you have to be willing to spend a lot of money on it. And those are two big hurdles.
Right.
Yeah. And even if you assume the information is correct online, something that a book offers you that the internet is so hard to find is context. You know, a beginning, a middle, and end, this is the discussion, and this is all of the information that falls underneath it. I feel like that's actually almost more exaggerated in marine information.
It is for sure. One of the only challenges though that I have with saltwater aquarium books is the amount of technology that goes into a saltwater aquarium, and that technology is constantly changing, and it does seem to have a little bit more of an effect on saltwater than on freshwater. But the context, one of the books sitting in front of me is Dr. Burgess Atlas of Marine Aquarium Fishes. And this is my personal copy that I've had for, I honestly don't know how long.
Clearly well-loved to yes. Anyone who can't see it, by the way.
Yes. And to have all of these pictures of all of these fish in one place, I spent hours upon hours upon hours upon hours learning from this book because of that. Which is why it's so beat up. That's the context, I think, that...
Well, and that's a very obvious, I don't think that there's a replacement for that on the internet or even like a comparable source of information.
Right.
In freshwater, there's a lot more trustworthy sources, I think.
There's definitely not a saltwater equivalent of Seriously Fish.
Right.
It's just not.
No, that's true.
Yeah. It's only websites that are selling fish that you get your information from. And it's not always great.
It's certainly biased. That's no doubt.
Yeah.
Does that mean we need to talk about the fact that we are a fish store and you just made that comment?
You know, I'm good with being called out on that. You're absolutely right that yes, we are biased. But here's a fun little fact. It is so hard to get wholesale pricing on books these days that we can say we are unbiased when we talk about the aquarium books that we like because we don't sell them.
That's true. Yeah, and I always like to say we work in an aquarium store because we're obsessed with fish, not the other way around.
Right. Yeah. So let's get into it. Let's talk about some of them. I want to talk a little bit more about this Dr. Burgess atlas of marine aquarium fishes. And I have to get, by the way, you guys said you're drinking your gin tonight. I am drinking, this is what is called an old ale or an old English ale. This would be based on a recipe from like 1652 or something like
that's
that.
So cool.
And it is a beer that I brewed myself.
I was about to say, don't you dare forget that.
Oh, no, don't worry.
She needs to know that.
Yeah, yes. I'm looking forward to a little taste of that after this. I think it'll be the nice.
It's delicious. Yeah. It's a nice malt forward beer with just a hint of hops, nothing too bitter. It's delightful. All right, where was I going with this book? Oh, yeah, this book
is... Look at pictures.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Of course, you opened it up to an angelfish page. Like,
I know, right?
His fingers, no.
Yeah, so this book is 750 some pages, including the extensive index. And I remember one of the things I always appreciated about the index is the index has both the scientific name and the common name, and sometimes multiple common names.
Oh, cool.
Right. So you can look it up under Coral Beauty, or you can look it up under Centropyge bisynctus. Bisynctus? All of a sudden that doesn't sound right. Hang on, let me look.
It's bispinosa.
Bispinosa. Thank you very much.
Yes.
As soon as I said it out loud.
Two spine.
Yep. Bispinosus. Two spine. Yep.
Stabby stab.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things Amy talked about with context, as I look at it, the way that this book is laid out, we talk a bit about taxonomic classification, taxonomic organization of species, and this fish book is somewhat organized by complex as well, and so you can start to get a sense of you can see the similarities between Coral Beauties and Flame Angels, and then the differences with some of the other angels that are in different complexes. And I think that that's really cool.
What is that all black one there? I don't think I've ever seen that.
That's Centropyge Nox.
It's pretty
cool.
Yeah,
the midnight angel. Occasionally they're available. They're a coral eating angel.
Yeah, most of them are.
Or more likely to eat than the angelfish in the complex that includes flames, potters, and...
I know better than to get too excited about an angel. I've been burned before.
I know, right?
You fall in love with it and then realize it eats your favorite coral or something.
Yeah. Ah. So yeah, this is a book that definitely sparked my interest, fed my interest in the hobby. So there we go.
Sorry, I want to respond and like have like a really good conversation about it, but I'm also just looking at the pictures.
So I should stop flipping through.
It's really distracting because it's just every page is beautiful.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing something I've never seen before on every page.
That's in this book. It's all of them. I mean, it's not all of them, right? But it's all of them that we know of, or that they knew of when the book was published. And it is not just aquarium fish. Although there's a lot of aquarium fish.
See, now it's the Antheus
page. Antheus, right? The big eyes. Look at how many different kinds of squirrelfish there are.
Ow.
They all look surprised.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great book. If you ever find it, run across it. I don't believe it is in print anymore. A pearlfish.
Cool.
Are you familiar with pearlfish?
No.
They live in the anus of a sea cucumber.
Oh, fun. Which is essentially a giant anus.
Yeah.
They live in the butthole's butthole.
We're going to get some negative comments on that one, I'm sure. Well, let's give Amy some gin and have her talk about...
Guys. Don't bring up sea cucumbers if you don't want to go there.
Right, that's true. I did actually catch one of these when I was in Jamaica.
Were you carrying a sea cucumber around?
Yes.
Like just by accident because you were collecting the sea cucumber?
We knew that that was a possibility, and we were collecting fish and organisms to put in the touch tanks and the show tanks to study them, and we put a sea cucumber in there in the hope that it would have a pearlfish in it, and it did.
Oh, that's so exciting. Yeah. It is kind of like finding a pearl, I guess.
They do, and they dart in backwards.
Cool.
Their tail is long and spiky-like, and that's how they dart into the sea cucumber.
Wow, that's so interesting. No, I have never heard of that before. Mm-hmm. See, we're learning new things today.
Crazy little fish.
I have no props today. I am just here to learn.
Well, there you go.
I don't know many of these books. Like, obviously, I know that book by reputation, but it's not something I have a personal relationship with the way that you do.
Yeah, it's great. So there we go. If you are looking for that you want your book that you can treat sort of like a catalog of saltwater fish. That's the book. Dr. Burgess, Atlas of Marine Aquarium Fishes. I have no idea. It's, you got to be able to find it used on Amazon, I would expect. I don't believe it is in print anymore, but I highly recommend picking it up.
Definitely a worthwhile collector book for anybody's shelf.
Mm-hmm. And so if we stay on the fish theme, I know Charles has the stack of Scott Michaels books sitting out.
Yeah.
And that's what did you bring to show the class?
The expanded version of this, where it's got a whole bunch of different fish in it, but then also a lot of detail about it. So the Burgess Atlas of Marine Aquarium Fish is really just a, here's a picture of the fish, here's where it's found, here's how big it gets, and here's a little bit more information about it. The Scott Michaels series goes into detail.
Specifically the Reef Fishes series, in case anyone wants to Google that.
And although the Sharks and Rays is technically not in the Reef Fishes series, it's in the Reef Fishes series. It's the same format. It's the same size. It looks really good on the shelf next to the rest of them, you know, and that matters.
They're the same size. They're the same sort of.
Yeah. Yep.
This is the Dottie back I was talking about this morning.
Ah, yes.
They're evil.
The oblique.
Anyways. Completely unrelated to this podcast, actually. All right, maybe it is relevant.
It is. Talk about that. That's how you know about that fish, right?
It's not, but it's relevant here because our instinctive response was not to look this up on Google. We all have smartphones at this table, but I said, oh, wait, it's in this book. Here you go. And there's the quick, like, spark notes you need to know about it. And I wouldn't even just say spark notes. That's not fair to this book. That because each species group or however he decides to divide it up in each individual book or each individual clade, I should say, or complex, I guess, in the context of this book. He does have an entire section devoted to, so here's their natural history. Here's their, this is where they're found. This is how you can keep them in aquariums. And then he'll go species by species and be like, he'll approach the dottiebacks in this book as like a general, this is how you take care of all dottiebacks. And then he'll go through each individual dottieback that he could think of and be like, okay, so this is how this one's different. Like this is how this one is an exception for this rule. This is how this one's, and that's really useful. Being able to look at like an entire group of like, or basslets, dottiebacks, hawkfishes, clownfishes, or stuff and be like, there is sort of common threads in how to take care of all of these, but they're all very individual from each other too.
Right. It helps when you have a description of a fish that you're interested in, and then you're looking at something related to it, and maybe you know this fish or you don't know this fish, but it's used to compare. Mm-hmm. If you know one of the two fish, if you're looking at orchid dottiebacks and neon dottiebacks, and you know orchid dottiebacks, and you read the section in that book where it talks about neon dottiebacks as being just a little feistier than an orchid, it gives you that perspective of exactly, oh, well, I know exactly what that means.
Yeah. And like that accumulation of knowledge is really hard to come by. Scott Michael, he is a hardcore marine biologist who just happens to really like keeping aquariums too. And we're really lucky that someone like that exists in the saltwater community.
Yeah, I sort of like, I see having these books, and especially this series, as like, it's a way to love something that you love even more. Like, I pretty much stream all the music that I listen to. Like, I'm a sellout, I'm on Spotify all the time. That doesn't really support artists, you know?
Right.
But if I really love something, I'll buy the physical album of it just to have a physical manifestation of how much that means to me. And having these books are like, well, you know, I've loved every basslet I've ever had, but this is proof of like how much I really want this fish and this whole thing in my life.
That's a pretty good analogy, because it gives you such a more intimate look at the whatever it is you're studying when you have a whole book dedicated to it. Just like having an actual album, you have what the artist meant when it was originally presented.
Not to mention, similarly to music, it's a way to get a little bit money back to the person who gave it to you.
Right, right.
That analogy is so spot on. I have one book in the Ruth Fishes series. It's the Anemone Fishes one.
Yeah.
Because that is the one, to people listening to the podcast who might not know, I really love anemone fishes. A lot of my schooling was in population genetics, and clownfishes are one of the few groups of reef fish out there that we have really good genetic data on. So I love being able to keep it in a tank, and then I can talk about, oh, okay, so this is like, this is what kind of polymorphism you're seeing here. And it's just fun. And so there isn't another book that's comparable out there that can talk about anemone fishes and clownfishes in such a holistic way like that. That's also applicable to keeping them in aquariums.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
What a treasure.
They've got, so in Scott Michael's series, I know he's got bassets, diddybacks, and hawkfishes, sharks and rays, angels and butterflies. I think there's a parrots and wrasse, but I don't think I have that one.
Yeah, you don't have that one, but it is book five.
And then there's reef fishes, which is just, I don't know, which that goes through a whole bunch of the families as well.
Yeah, if that one is actually reef fishes, probably volume like one. The briefest overview. That one has frogfishes, squirrelfishes, seahorses, dwarf sea basses, and more.
Uh-huh. That one's just like a wild and crazy time. That's a fun one to flip through. There's just a lot of weird stuff in there.
A lot of people got really annoyed with the Reef Fishes series, actually, though, because each book they were like, there was fewer and fewer stuff. And I was like, yeah, and there's more and more information as each book goes along, because like Scott was very clearly figuring out that he had more than he actually wanted to say.
Yeah, that one book just wasn't enough.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I say the naysayers are in the wrong here. So I'm saying it now. He could have released four more books and I would have ate them up.
It's probably two. Except people don't talk about fish books like they used to.
I know.
Which is, you know, part of the point of this podcast. Wait, so you just covered up the next book I want to talk about.
I actually wanted to talk about the Aquarium Sharks and Rays one a little bit more.
Fine.
Because this was the first aquarium book I bought for myself.
Nice.
A lot of my other aquarium books were either gifts from my mom's friends or I inherited from my mom. Aquarium Sharks and Rays was the first one I bought by me for me.
That's very cool.
So that's a very special book to me. That was the first aquarium book that really truly honed in to me on the internet's got nothing on this.
Oh, like right.
That book is invaluable to anyone uh-huh. who's interested in keeping sharks and rays in tanks. I would wholeheartedly argue that if you want to keep aquarium sharks and rays and you don't own that book, you're doing something wrong.
I don't think I can disagree with you on that.
So
one of the things I greatly appreciate about that book is he's realistic about it.
Yeah.
He talks about nurse sharks as being great aquarium sharks.
Yep.
If you are willing to provide a tank big enough. By the way, 14,000 gallons, I believe, is the size that he talks about. But if you're willing to provide a 14,000 gallon aquarium, nurse shark is a great choice.
Yeah, he approaches it in a very like matter of fact way, like, yeah. Oh no, this is bad for Aquarius because it gets too big. It's not, no, if you have this size tank, this is how you do it.
I wish more people would have that attitude, because then we could tell people why you probably don't want a clown knife.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like you say that, and I like, that's one of those introspective moments for me where I'm like, I don't talk like that though. Like right. I wish more people did, but I am not one of those. That's one of those like be the change you want to see in the world yeah. situations, I guess.
It's a mm-hmm. mindset shift for people who kind of came up with aquariums, especially if you've been doing it for a long time. It's a hard mindset to get yourself into because you're just so used to the like you and everyone else, you know, what can I get away with mentality? Yeah. And like, yeah. No, like what can you do amazing? Because there's like so many things. Totally.
Also the maybe overly trust mentality that, well, if they're selling it at a pet store, it must be okay.
Yeah.
right. yeah. All right. Next book.
Breeding the Orchid Dotted Beck, an Aquarius journal. This is the one I'm assuming you want to talk about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that is the only book I've ever literally thrown across the room.
must be a good one then.
I'm picturing like that Amazon review. It's one of the best books I've ever read. I literally threw it across the room.
So, yeah, that one actually, I did actually meet Martin Moe. That one is a signed copy. Wait, is that the one? Maybe the other one is. There's one around that is signed by Martin Moe. So that book is, it's his personal journal about breeding orchidotybacks, where he goes through the step-by-step process for breeding them. And I did, you know, the classic, you know, here's the instruction manual. So you start the process before you, you know where it says, read through the instructions thoroughly before beginning this process. I didn't do that. I just
That's when you throw them away.
Right. I just followed along with Martin Moe along that process. And this was in the early days of marine fish breeding. Well, okay, unless you're Martin Moe, because he was breeding gray angelfish, I think, in 1976.
Yeah, well, we're not Martin Moe, and we're not right. gods either. So.
But this was when there were, when I was working on these fish, there were a few species of tank-raised clownfish available, and like one or two species of dottybacks were just starting to come out. And Martin Moe wrote this book, and I thought, all right, I'm doing it. And I was... this is before I was involved in the business, but I was very good friends with the owner of a different local aquarium store at the time. And he said, all right, I will sort of sponsor you and your dottyback project if I get, you know, a certain percentage of the babies. I'm like, sweet, let's do this. So he hooked me up with all kinds of equipment. He helped me work on getting pairs of dottybacks. And this whole time I'm reading through this book going, yep, yep, I got that set up like that. Okay, I did this a little differently, but this is why, and it's good. And I'm reading this book. I'm like, all right, it's doing this. And
I want to interrupt you real quick, only because the audience can't see this. I'm smirking right now because I know where this story goes, and it makes me laugh every time. So continue, Ben, please.
All right. The biggest challenge with breeding most species of reef fish is feeding the newborn fry. So many of these fish are so teeny tiny and need something live to trigger that feeding response. Now we've come up with some solutions to that, but back in, this was probably 1999, 2000, right in that era, you couldn't go to LG Barn and buy live rotifers or live anything, right? I did manage to get my hands on some rotifer cultures like once, but that was, it was really tricky to get those. So anyway, I'm reading this book and I had gotten to the point where I got my dottybacks to produce egg masses and multiple times and on a semi-regular basis. And then it's the time, the section, the chapter on feeding the fry. I'm like, yes, this is, and I was brimming with excitement on being able to read this next part. For those of you that know me, I am not an avid reader. I don't sit down with a good book all the time unless it's got a lot of good pictures in it. Occasionally, but pretty much I don't. But this one, I was pouring through it. And I get to the section and I turn the page and I see the word plankton toe. Like, you son of a... threw the book across the room. I live in Michigan. You can't do a plankton toe for marine species in Michigan. He lived on the coast, and so he would do a plankton toe, and that was how he would get the teeny tiny food to feed his baby orchid dottybacks.
Damn it.
Throw the book across the room, find another solution. I successfully got my orchid dottybacks to 7 days. And
which is, by the way, for context, amazing.
Yeah, with no access to live food. I got them to 7 days actually on sponge grunge.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
So cool.
But yes, so even other than the plankton toe section, if you are getting into fish breeding, that is a
essential
must have.
Also in part, I think for me the most valuable aspect of this was how so this is written as like a journal entries or like a
yeah.
blog.
Yeah.
And his consistent struggles and his like days of being highly discouraged and being like, how am I going to get past this?
Yes.
Like that is very contextualizing to someone who's thinking about breeding marine fish. It's like, it can be daunting, but being able to see that like someone like this, he got through it and he did it. And like, that's invaluable encouragement, but also like, just for me, a lot of the like attempts or like attempts at stuff he tried, like my personal favorite was, I think it was ciliate cultures. He tried culturing them on V8 juice because he was desperate.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And I was like, yeah. That's a solution I would have, like, it didn't work, but that's a solution I right. would have never tried or thought of.
Yeah, you would have tried something else that didn't work.
Yeah, exactly. And so just being able to watch, like, I don't know, I shouldn't say watch, but being able to like go through that process of figuring things out as he was amazing.
It makes the process seem so attainable.
Yes.
Particularly now that we don't have to do a plankton tow, we can go to an online source and buy live foods that are proven to successfully raise newborn hatchling. There we go. Larval dottybacks. But everything else about that book is so, oh, well, that sounds pretty simple. And it really is.
Sounds like it's time to try again.
I think it absolutely is time to try again. In fact, I drilled a hole in the tank today to...
did you break it?
No, I did not. I successfully drilled a hole in the tank today.
Guys, that's huge.
I know.
That's like important. You didn't even tell me that?
I just told you that right now.
There's a cute little like thumb-sized bulkhead in it too.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. I'm so excited.
Yep. All right. So there we go. Breeding the Orca Daddy Back by Dr. Martin Moe. Highly recommend it. Follow some of Martin Moe's stuff because he's a pretty cool guy making a lot of amazing contributions to the hobby.
Yeah. Like there's this particular aquaculture facility with orchid dottybacks that I really like.
Yeah. 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 And yes, he did breed gray angelfish in 1976.
That is not wrong, by the way.
Right.
That is confirmed by two people at this table.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pioneer.
Yep. For sure.
Is that like the only, I don't know, like this is a very hands-on, practical, like how-to guide. Most of the books that I'm seeing are more like overviews of genera, overviews of families. Do we have any other, like in the freshwater one, there were all sorts of like, this is how you do a freshwater aquarium. This is how you do a planted aquarium. This is how you do an aquascape. Do we have good saltwater books like that?
Well, funny you should ask, Amy, because I think the next book on deck just happens to be that.
I actually have no idea what really? Book you're talking about. So it's perfect. A genuine question, it's not a setup.
It's sitting in front of Charles.
Oh, is that that one says clownfishes. That still seems like it's just a clownfish book.
It is a clownfish book, but this is Clownfishes by Joyce Wilkerson. And there is a detailed breeding project in there for clownfish. If you want an instruction manual for breeding clownfish, that's the book.
She and these instructions are, this is how I do it, because she's a clownfish breeder.
Yeah,
cool.
Or at least was. I don't know what she's doing these days.
I'm not sure,
but like I just wanted to read some chapter headings just to give you an idea. Broodstock aquarium, foods and feeding, spawning, live food cultures, metamorphosis, and the juvenile period.
Cool.
Like this is like, if you want to breed clownfishes, this is the book.
That is the book.
Some of her setup, this was written in 2001, I think, or at least published. Mm-hmm. I don't know when she wrote it.
Yeah, that's probably accurate.
But so some of the like the equipments she used are probably a little outdated, but like if you want to raise clownfish that way, this is very clearly a viable way to
yeah.
do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's a true testament to how easy clownfish are to work with, is that, wow, like you're looking back and I'm like, she was using under gravel filters to breed clownfish.
Yeah. Yeah. And that book, it's super practical. That is the one if you want to get into breeding fish, you should buy that book before Martin Moe's book. You should still get Martin Moe's book if you want to get into it. But
I got a book here. I know you haven't read that. It's even better for that.
Ooh, I like it.
But we'll get to that.
Yeah. If you're going to start with breeding fish, saltwater fish, you should start with clownfish. And if you're going to breed saltwater clownfish, you should start with that book.
Let me look at this clownfish book. I've never seen it before. I don't think I've seen it before.
It's amazing.
Do you have this one too, Ben? Like, in, that's mine. This is your copy. His. Okay.
I have it on Kindle. So I have to borrow his.
Oh, I think there's a copy of that one downstairs, though.
There is. You do have two copies.
Okay.
I've probably never noticed it. This is beautiful.
It's great.
Great shots. Ooh. Yeah, and very well broken down. To talk about it as a manual or whatever, like, this is, there's so many pictures, there's so many diagrams, it's beautiful.
Oh. This is a great callback.
Food
here.
Web.
So, you know how I worked on producing that McCulloch-Eye pear downstairs?
Yes.
That was me working on how she makes white striped clown, maroon clown pears.
Oh, so there we go. Yes. Those are the practical applications, because those clowns look really good in our display and they haven't killed each other yet.
Because I know. That's great.
I thought, hey, this is a species of clown that notoriously kills each other. The same principles should apply, right?
Yeah. Let's open up the book and see how to do it. That's great.
So I think that's a great segue into, I alluded to it. So I got a book that I don't think you've read.
Which one?
The Complete Illustrated Breeder's Guide to Marine Aquarium Fishes by Matthew Wittenrick.
Oh, yeah. I've read that book. It's great.
Really? Yeah. It's good.
I don't, excuse me, I don't have it.
Yeah.
But yeah,
that book's amazing.
Phenomenal.
If you want to breed demersal spawning marine fish, I don't think there's a better book.
Yep.
And I kind of love that book. And it's kind of inspiring to me because I think it was published in 2008. And it talks about pelagic spawning fish as like the, this is the cutting edge. Hopefully we'll crack it soon. And like, so pelagic spawning fish are things like wrasses, antheas, and
angels
and tangs. And these are all things that we're figuring out now. And it's just like, I truly think the marine hobby right now is experiencing like a renaissance. Like the last, like, I think the last 5 years or so, we've figured out how to breed more fish than we did in the 20 years before that. And it just like that sort of like thing, it's mind boggling to me every year, like the things that people have managed to breed. Like we have captive bred, not tank raised, captive bred majestic angelfish downstairs right now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's amazing.
Every day I look at those and I'm like awestruck, because that blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. And they are so hardy.
Oh my God.
It's 2000 to 2010 was just like a golden age for aquarium books. That was when publishing sort of became available to people that, I don't know, it became available on a different level. You didn't have to go through like one of the big publishers or prove yourself tremendously to be able to publish a book. You could do it with limited resources. And it was just before the internet really took over everything. Right about 2010, everything switched over to the internet, and
yeah,
there are not fish books being published like they used to. But this whole stack, these top three were all between 2000 and 2010, at least the reprint, the reissues of them.
Yeah.
I would kill for new fish books.
I know.
Like,
I know.
This is fantastic information, but things have changed.
Yes.
I think the most recent marine aquarium book I own is Matt Pedersen's Bengai Cardinalfish book.
That's definitely a newer one.
I think that was 2012. I don't have my copy here because I'm an idiot, but that book was really cool. I cannot describe to people how cool that book was. It had a couple different sections. It had a section on natural history, and that section of the book was written by a guy whose entire career is Bengai cardinalfish natural history. Maybe not his entire career, but he's the guy that discovered them and described them.
Oh, Gerald Allen?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then another section written by a person who works at them in this capacity, and there are three parts, and I'm... But of course, the most interesting part to a person like us was the part written by Matthew Pedersen was care and breeding of Bangai Conlon fishes in the home aquarium, and like these are different strategies people have used, and like he even goes so far as to like describe it as, so if you want a production breed Bangai Conlon fish, here are your options. These are four different ways that have worked for me. This is how, and he even breaks down the math of like, so if you're doing XYZ, you can theoretically grow this many in this time frame. Like he approaches it as like, if you're a mom and pop aquarium breeder trying to breed for production to wholesale.
Right.
And it was just really enlightening and like almost jarring in how like, what's the word I'm looking for? How unnervingly frank he is and how hard that is.
Yes. Gerald Allen, by the way, if you look at fish books written in the 80s, if it's a saltwater fish book, it probably has Gerald Allen's name on it. There's, I think, three Gerald Allen books on the shelf there.
Yeah.
And then if you look at a saltwater fish where the species name is Alleni, like the Allen's damsel, that's named after Gerald Allen.
The best damsel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not a codfish.
Right. Yeah. So Gerald Allen's one of those people that you just, he was a groundbreaking, prolific aquarium fish or aquarium author.
Well, yeah. That's because he was going around finding everything and being a cool guy.
Yeah. Yeah. He was part of a lot of the expeditions that discovered a lot of the deep water centropies and paracentropies angels too. Bob Fenner. We'll talk about him yet.
Yeah. What a cool guy.
Speaking of cool guys, The Conscientious Marine Aquarium by the late, great Bob Fenner. Bob was somebody who I even kind of considered a little bit of a friend. Bob was super cool guy. Conscientious Marine Aquarium is, it's a book, it's a little more of a how-to, and it's written from the philosophy of doing it right and being conscientious about how you're doing it, being someone who cares about what's going into the tank, how they're going to live, where they came from, all that stuff. And so that, I think that would be, I'm really getting serious about this hobby. That's a book that should be on everybody's shelf.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. That book is just that type of perspective. And that's why I really like, we were talking about like the internet versus stuff. A lot of the internet is very like matter of fact and not a good way. Whereas Bob Fenner, at least in this book, approaches it as like, we have a responsibility and this and that's the type of context you like, even other books we've talked about here don't really touch on in specifically that way. Like they'll talk about like how to do it and how to do it right, but that's not the same as doing it ethically.
True. And Bob was definitely a let's do it ethically. We had him come to do a couple of talks at the local aquarium club. Probably it was 2009, 2010, right around that era. And talk about somebody with a lot of energy. I mean, that guy was, he was amazing. Yep. He was a cool guy. And a great book.
Yeah, I think anyone who keeps aquariums has to kind of confront that eventually. And it's even more important in like marine aquariums where you just have to figure out your personal justification and the overall justification for like why we get to do this and what's important. And so for it to appear in an actual like book from somebody else is really validating, I think.
Yeah.
Like that's not a struggle you have to go through alone. And there are answers to those questions.
This is a hobby for us, but for these organisms, this is literally life and death.
That's definitely a good way to think about it. Books.
I got one I want to talk about. This is the newest, to me, the most recent one I've read. I picked it up 4 months ago.
Ooh.
In the store, and famously or maybe infamously not particularly excited about inverts in the store. I have tried very hard to understand inverts in a way that can allow me to answer questions, but it's not. And I actually have some books on your shelf back there that I'd like to talk about later. But relating to that, but this was the first case where I looked at an invert, got really excited, and it was like the hyperfixation you have for a while. You're like, and so the book is Giant Clams in the Sea and in the Aquarium by James Fatherly.
Definitely the authority on giant clams.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. He is, for the aquarium.
He is so cool. if you really, if you don't have access to the book, he did a Magna talk on clams. Now that one is going to be a little bit more techie in that talk is very much in the context of, different species of clams and how they're different from each other and how we tell them apart, which is fascinating in its own right, but it's a little different. But this talks about their biology, their natural history, and how to take care of them in an aquarium. And so that clam video we filmed like a week ago, that is me saying to anyone listening this, you probably hear this podcast before that video gets released because that's just how our video programming works. So stay tuned for that. But very much the style of how I wanted to break down topics and that was related to this because he very easily and seamlessly went from... So what interested me was this is a photosynthetic filter feeding organism. That's mm-hmm. so weird. And so he starts off there and he's talking about... So here's the weird biology. So anyways, this is how you keep it alive in a tank with that weird biology in mind. And I'm like, that is a really easy transition for me to make where it's like, okay, so here's the theoretical, here's the application of that.
That's kind of what we need to hear as aquarists is, you know, that a lot of the stuff that we read about when we're reading a little quick, like how do we take care of this fish I like online? We lose the natural history.
Yeah.
If we only get the natural history, we don't get the, okay, that's great that it lives in this certain part of the ocean at this depth. But what does that mean for me wanting to take care of it?
A great example of that is that Corals of the World book series.
Yes.
I that is very much like an identification of wild corals. And that was like my techie read through it. And I read through it very briefly and I realized I still have no idea how to take care of corals.
But you learned a lot.
I did.
Yeah. That book is the holy grail of every coral that we knew about when those books were written. That series is, it's an amazing series. But if you want to know how to keep them alive, either Julian Sprung's coral book or Eric Bornemann's coral book, you need those.
Yeah, those are way more.
Yeah, way more the there's not quite as much natural history in those books. But the care, it's there.
See, I love, like, that's such a cool book. I really love it. This is, to me, where the need for new aquarium books really starts to come out.
Right.
Because if I try to research coral taxonomy and relationships on the internet, I may as well just, like, go cry and run away.
Well, but keep in mind that the scientists actually studying leather corals also go cry when they try to do that.
I know, but like, I just want it to be organized. I want it to be sorted. But they're working on it. And so many of the names, so many of the relationships in those books have changed. The care is still the same. That's the good thing.
The care is the same. That's true. Look at the picture. Mine looks like the picture.
Yeah. Good. Mine that looks sort of similar sort to of the works. Picture and it's still probably the same care. That's kind of the nice thing about corals too, is you can really kind of generalize in a lot of ways, but
their growth form is determined by their environment, and we're trying to provide an environment. So if it's a similar growth form, chances are good it's likely. Notice I didn't have any committal words there, right? Uh-huh. Chances are good it's likely their care is going to be at least similar.
Right. Shake the magic eight ball again and tell me what it says. Right. All signs point to yes.
Yeah.
I would like to here put my little plug for reef aquariums versus planet aquariums. I do think that a lot of people get put off by reef aquariums because they think they're more complicated. I would argue that I think a lot of people like freshwater aquariums are more intuitive, especially when you're working in. But if you really start looking at it, at least from a technical standpoint, I'm really starting to switch to the mindset of I think keeping corals alive is easier. There's way less, like,
yeah,
there's less. There's more generalization you can make.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, the same way that I would keep a red root floater or any other plant in an aquarium.
Even any other floater, like the water chemistry they need, mm-hmm. the circulation they're able to take is mm-hmm. different.
It's not the same.
Yeah. The water chemistry of the ocean is, for all intents and purposes, the same in the Caribbean as it is in the Red Sea, as it is in Indonesia.
I'm going to tease you a little bit. Now, technically, the Red Sea is saltier, but more or less...
Functionally. Right,
functionally. The portions and stuff.
Yeah. Essentially the same.
Yeah. They're,
right.
It's just like... So I just... And I harp on it so much because I spent so long thinking that reef aquariums were more complicated and harder to do. And then it really took literally one conversation with Amy once where I suddenly, like, a light bulb clicked and I was like, oh, man, what?
The idea of, like, because the difference is testing is more important. And yeah. the idea that mm-hmm. that's something you would be freaked out on, even you would recognize that's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so, I don't know, just like... Amy is really good at reframing something towards an individual person. And like that specific conversation was her being like, no, Charles, X, Y, Z. And then suddenly my brain, like the puzzle pieces fit together. And I was like, whoa. So I very mm-hmm. much, currently as of April 26, 2021, will die on the hill of, that I think overall reef aquariums are simpler. I'm not going to say they're easier. I think from a, if you were looking at water chemistry standpoint, I think they're simpler to work with.
Sorry, I just got distracted because I opened up this coral book to the page of the coral I'm literally working with right now. So you guys can keep talking if you want to. Yeah. It has a different name, but it does look exactly the same in the picture.
She's the podcast for this digression. I don't know. But.
She is flipping through Eric Borneman's aquarium corals book, which I think Julian Sprungs has the same name.
This just is Aquarium Corals, Selection, Husbandry, and Natural History.
If I'm remembering correctly, though, Scott Michael's Reef Fishes series is the same publisher as this.
If yeah, TFH is, Microcosm.
There we go.
They, like, most, I think all of the books that we've talked about tonight so far, except for maybe Martin Moe's book, is a TFH Microcosm book. They published... Aquarium books.
Microcosm existed.
What's that?
I miss when Microcosm existed.
I know, right? Yeah. Odd Konings, his Cichlid Press is not. And then I look at that Orchid Dottyback book and see the Corals of the World is not. But I mean, all of the rest of them are.
Green Turtle Publications.
Okay, so that one's not. Julian Sprung might not be a Microcosm author, but I don't remember on that one exactly. Eric Borneman was whatever, however you'd say that at this time.
This was published by Liquid Medium.
Oh, the James Feathery book.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
It kind of makes sense that he would be published by this, only because it's located in Tampa, Florida.
Okay.
Given that he's in this description, it says, currently a physical and environmental sciences instructor in a community college in Tampa, Florida, by the way. If
right.
People don't have that context.
Right.
Sorry, I went down a coral hole. That happens to me a lot.
All right, we got really distracted there.
I need to spend some time with that book on another day.
Do we want to talk about the other coral book, or do you want to talk about that next book in that stack? Because I'm ready for that one if you
the
are.
The Plankton Culture Manual?
Yeah!
Tangentially related to the corals I was just looking up.
So the Plankton Culture Manual is... this is like right up Charles's alley. This is like super techie.
This is a laboratory manual on how to maintain planktons in a lab.
Yeah. So go maintain some plankton cultures
exactly.
for us.
And why do we care about plankton?
That was the book. I got that book after throwing Martin Moe's book across the room.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is, mm-hmm. I'm not going to say it's the most up-to-date but it's the most comprehensive, readily accessed to a hobbyist published way of how to maintain this crap.
And so at that point, the closest that we could come to try and get phytoplankton was to try and use some harvested live rock and make green water with it.
Yeah, this book is really
and then hopefully
cool.
use that to feed your rotifers and hopefully use those
really
to
hard.
Feed your little larval fry.
And this book has sections on microalgae cultures, rotifers, ciliates, artemia, copepods, daphnia, and even oyster and clam larvae, by the way.
Cool.
Yeah. Well, and that was the process back in in the 90s. It was you set up a system to grow phytoplankton so that you could feed that to another system to grow rotifers. So you could feed that to another system to try to grow your dottybacks. That you got the eggs out of another system where the dottybacks bred. So really to get those going, and Martin Moe talks about that in his book, it's like five or six different isolated systems. And if you have on the off chance you accidentally get some rotifers, like a rotifer in your phytoplankton culture,
it's done.
All of a sudden they eat all your phytoplankton and it's gone.
You have another rotifer culture now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And rotifers are teeny tiny, so that would be really easy.
Yeah.
Just the wrong pipette.
Yeah. If your feed line, if you have because you would set it up so there'd be a direct feed from your phytoplankton culture to your rotifer culture. If you had that as a stream instead of a drip, the rotifers could swim up.
Wow.
Yep. Dun, so it has dun. To be a drip. Oh, and not a drip that splashes.
Because they can transfer via the splashes too,
right.
by the way.
It's ridiculous. Why would anyone try to do this?
Well, and nowadays we can buy phytoplankton.
Oh, that's why people would try to do this.
Yeah. Now we can do it.
Because there's these nice lab manuals everywhere that people in labs are now doing it and making money by selling it to people like me who don't want to do it myself.
Thank God.
And now the transition stage to get them from that rotifer stage to the next, to where they'll start to actually take prepared foods is much, much shorter.
Yeah. Or even a lot of people are experimenting with prepared foods for copepods, which blows my mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
The next book in the stack is Marine Aquarium and Miniature Reefs. This is an outdated guide.
Okay.
Right. So this book, I think it was probably 1986. Let me just see when the date on this book was.
Well, miniature reefs have come a long way since I started working here, 6 years ago now. So I can't imagine any longer than that how different this would be.
It's terrifying to me how much the hobby is different than when I started.
It's not terrifying to me. It's very exciting to me.
It just makes me feel old.
Yes, but it's progressing in such an inspiring and positive way, I think.
I just don't want in 20 years to have that moment where I realize I'm the outdated old guy who hasn't changed the way
Listen,
I keep aquariums.
If we're the outdated old people in 20 years, that means we've done a pretty good job.
All right, fair. I'll accept it. I don't want to be the epitome of aquarium keeping. Let's put it that way.
Yes, I know what you mean.
1990 was when this book was published.
So 30 years ago.
Yep.
More than 30 years ago.
Although there's definitely some value in it. It's definitely referring to undergravel filters and damselfish to cycle in aquarium.
Mm-hmm.
And keeping, it specifically talks about keeping cleaner wrasses in your tank to reduce parasites.
It's definitely a time capsule.
Yeah, and look at how the picture of how healthy the cleaner wrasses look.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
They look so bad. Why did they take a picture of that? Because it looked... That's the way they were supposed to look.
That looked good for a cleaner wrasse in 1990.
You know, I think that it's still valuable to have this stuff. And the stuff that did work at the time, you can still learn a lot from. Like undergravel filters... Easy to operate, lots of oxygenation, and it's a standard cheap filter that you can get. We do the same thing with Hang on the Backs now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So principles don't change much, but philosophy has changed a ton.
You can definitely see that that book is pretty beat up. That was, yeah. I think that was probably the first big saltwater aquarium book that I had. And so I pored over that book. Yeah. There's pictures of Amy right now is flipping through, and there are pictures of, the melon butterfly fish, which might qualify as the most elegant looking aquarium fish. I mean,
I can see that.
I'm picturing him with like a wine glass being like, quite.
In like a pinstripe suit.
How quaint.
But they talk about that as a viable aquarium fish, and they are an obligatory corallivore.
They do actually say it requires living coral. It should be avoided. So.
Oh, that's good.
So they did good on that
All right,
one.
That's good.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, if your corals are only going to live like 2 weeks.
Well, yeah. You know? A steady supply of wild caught Acropora colonies and keep it alive as long as you want. But you can see the pictures of the fish.
Mm-hmm.
They don't look very good.
Yeah, here's like a really textbook example of head and lateral line erosion that's gone way too far. That says, we don't know why yellow tangs do that sometimes.
Right. You know? Well, now we do.
Yes, now we do. Yep. And now we avoid those things. So.
And we can even reverse it in some cases.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by stuff like this because if you're cautious, I think you can still learn a ton.
I agree. I think last time I did a call out on a certain book, and hopefully there are some saltwater aquarium book enthusiasts listening to this podcast or hear this podcast. There is a book that was published in, I believe it was 1972. And it has a section in there on keeping sea turtles. I really want that book. No, not because I want to keep a sea turtle, but the historical perspective on that book. There are so many things in that book that are just, I remember reading something about damselfish are particularly hardy, sometimes surviving up to 6 months.
Yeah, that's what we don't like to hear.
Right. So if anybody knows, I cannot remember the name. I've seen the book a couple of times. If anybody knows the name of that book, I really would like to get my hands on a copy of it. So please, give us a little reach out to let me know the name of that book. What other books, guys?
Microcosm Reef Aquariums one right there in the front of that section right there.
Natural Reef Aquariums. That was a groundbreaker.
Yeah. That one was actually another really new addition into my life because... you loaned this one to Allie. And so when she brought it back, this is the genuine story. I was eating lunch and she had left it on the table. And I said, and I started reading through it. And I was like, wow, this is really cool.
That was when the shift was happening from these sterile, dead coral skeletons and... The name of the substrate that we used was crushed coral. That's literally what it was called, was crushed coral. And that's what it was. Into aquariums that have stuff from the natural environment, the use of live rock, the use of live sand. That book goes into some detail about just why that's such a good idea.
It's funny that things have kind of shifted back the other way.
I know it is.
This was a really fun read for me because my first marine aquarium was set up with the philosophy presented in this book.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt so cutting edge at the time. And it's not, and I'm glad it's not, because this was very clearly like new territory for everyone. It was a little unnerving. And this book was written in 2001, I think. And I set up my first saltwater aquarium in 2007, so I very clearly benefited from those pioneers. But just being able to see, this was a very nostalgic journey was this book, but also just the philosophy behind it between like behind the idea of it doesn't need to be a sterile environment, like mm-hmm. you said. This mm-hmm. It's a living, breathing ecosystem, and you can make that, that's attainable and doable and possible, and I just love that.
It's an amazing number of books, and I'm staring at my bookshelf and which ones to talk about. I mean, we've got Anthony Kelfo's book.
I can't believe neither of us grabbed it. The Reef Aquarium, Volume 1 and 2. What is wrong with us?
It's because I don't have Volume 3.
That's okay.
Volume 1, 2, and 3. This is Charles holding up Volume 3 right now. We have it, I promise.
Is that Dielbick and Sprung?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, man.
Charles Dielbick was from the Hawaii Aquarium, right?
I think
and then,
so, yeah.
And then went on to the Monterey Bay. And then Julian Sprung, Two Little Fishes is his company.
Oh, interesting.
Now, I was just talking about the Cutting Edge Pioneer, and you were talking about this. This was published in Volume 2 was in 1997. This was at the beginning, initial stages.
Yeah.
And when I said I wanted to start a reef aquarium, my mom has copies of these. These were the books she's handed me.
Nice. I traded.
Sorry, I'm just laughing at it. This is him talking about every single way to like attach rocks and coral and stuff together.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a little section I'm chewing gum here.
Really?
And it says, instead of dental cement, it is possible to use chewing gum as a locking device. Chew it first to remove the flavoring and then soak it in ice water to give it a firm consistency. Don't tell anyone what you're doing. Oh, that got a laugh
awesome.
Out of me.
Awesome.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah.
You were in the middle of saying something.
I don't
sorry.
Remember. It was not something super important.
It was not important as that joke was.
Oh, I traded actually one of our current customers for my copy of book two, Pete Gettner.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how long I've known Pete.
That's so cool.
Yep. But he ended up with two copies of, I think it was Reef Aquarium book two. Yeah,
this is amazing. Bringing,
yeah.
These books are amazing. I think that, oh man, if you are only going to buy like five books for keeping marine aquariums and you're really into corals, I think the Reef Aquarium volumes 1-3 would be near top contenders there for you.
Yeah. Bob Fenner's Conscientious Marine Aquarium.
Definitely, there's no question in my mind that's on the list.
Either Eric Borneman's Corals book or Julian Sprung's book. I lean slightly toward Eric Borneman's book. And then specialize.
Yeah.
What's your focus? If you're a fish person, go to Scott Michaels. If you're a clam person, go to James Feathery. If you're a coral person, get the other, whichever one you didn't get, and then also the Corals of the World book. And then Anthony Kelfo's Book of Coral Propagation.
Yeah.
That's a
okay, that's
great
fair.
How
it's
to propagate.
Called Book of Coral Propagation,
yeah.
By the way. He's not being like colloquial here.
He even gives you detailed instructions in that book on how to build a coral propagation greenhouse.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Anthony Kelfo and Bob Fenner collaborated on the Reef Invertebrates book. And so they go into detail about all of the mobile invertebrates we'd put or not want to put in a reef aquarium. So crabs and shrimp and clams and all of the rest of those creatures. It's a great book. So where do you focus on? I mean, you know, we've just been going off and off in all these different directions and tangents with this particular podcast on these different books.
Have fun, Nick.
Yeah. Nick, by the way, would be our podcast editor. There's so many good books out there. I think that's the kicker. I don't think anybody should be without Bob Fenner's book. I think I'm going to go with that as like, okay, I want to start my collection. Bob Fenner's Conscientious Marine Aquarium. And then we have people that come in the store and say, I'm doing my reef aquarium. I know I should have some corals in there, but really it's about the fish. Or I really don't care about fish. I just want corals. And then it's two different directions for the books.
Yeah.
Or even I just want a bunch of pretty fish that get along, or I really care about this fish.
Yeah.
Like it's the nice thing about this is you can find someone who wants to go deep into whichever subject you're interested in. So
right.
you don't have to take our word for it.
Yeah. And the books are all there.
Yeah.
I've spent a lot of time with all of them.
And I also want to talk about something. Like, I want to have a specific digression on this topic here. I really think discussions like this are really valuable because I'm the type of person that is very prone to getting like stuck in my own head with my own thoughts. And so like I brought up like Amy recontextualizing corals for me and stuff like that. And you don't, that won't happen unless you're reading a book with someone with a slightly different viewpoint, or you're in a room with someone with a slightly different viewpoint. And I think it's very important for you to challenge your own ideals or your ideas or how you feel about something, because if your opinion on something can't stand being tested, then maybe it's not a very good opinion, you know?
Yeah.
And
I like
so,
that.
I guess this is me being thankful that I'm lucky enough to have these discussions with you guys here every day with our customers every day. Like, I get to interact with people on like the local aquarium club Facebook page and stuff like that. And so if you don't have that type of interaction in your life and you're really into aquarium keeping, I highly encourage you to seek it out, or even just comment on our Facebook page or something. I don't care. Like any sort of like that sort of dialogue, it's worthwhile and it's amazing. And I never thought I'd be lucky enough to make a career out of doing that, but it's great.
It's so much more fun that way too.
Yeah.
Well, we have books here that talk about where we came from, and books that help us recognize really just how far we've come. Some of these books do a pretty good job of making us realize just how simple things really are.
How far we have to go.
I have a customer that I tell almost every day at some point, I'm going to have a conversation where I'm like, dude, literally every day I learn something where I'm like, man, that would have been useful to know like 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, for sure. We have books for those people that want to specialize in something, and we have books for people that want to generalize, and we have books for people that just want to dream.
Look at pretty pictures.
I definitely did a lot of that. But I'm a book person, and that's why we have this big, huge stack of books. That's why we're having this conversation tonight. So please, if you listen to this podcast and you have a favorite book that we didn't talk about, or one that we did talk about, let me know what you like and why I should revisit that book. Or if there's one that I'm like, hey, this book changed the way that I looked at aquariums, let me know.
Our money.
Yeah, I want some.
We need more
books. I want some more information. I want some more ideas on great aquarium books.
But be sure to take the discussion over to our Facebook page. You can also leave a comment on our website underneath this episode. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas of an episode you'd like us to do, this aquarium books episodes, these were a special request. So I'm glad we got that one. This was really fun. Make sure to like us on Facebook and Instagram, and definitely check out the YouTube channel. We abbreviate our subjects a little bit more there, so it might be a little bit better for that.
Yeah.
A little bit more user-friendly.
Right. You don't have to listen to us ramble on for an hour to get the information.
Well, you know, if you don't want to listen to us ramble on to get information, just pick up a good book.
True.
Maybe we need to do more book club videos.
Yeah. That was really fun, too. Right. I got a good response.
Well, thank you so much for listening. Let's have lots of fun and keep those hands wet. Unless, of course, you're picking up a book, then dry your hands first. But thanks for listening.